Welcome to Book Talk. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode. I hope everybody had a wonderful Book Week Scotland, a celebration of the book here in Scotland. Loads of activities and events, and hopefully you got a chance to go out and see some of those great things that were happening throughout the entire country. Of course, if you didn't get a chance to, we've got a podcast chock full of some of the things you might have missed or didn't get a chance to see. And also, you could still take part in a lot of things online. The Who in Fiction Are You quiz, you can find it on our Facebook page right now. I saw loads of my friends throughout the world, people in Australia and America and Singapore, taking this quiz and being compared to Holly Golightly and Edgar Allan Poe and stuff. It's a really fun little thing, and you get a cool little drawing of a cool literary character. So do check that out via our Facebook page. Also, throughout Scotland, we revealed a whole bunch of secret murals that were painted on the sides of libraries all over the country. There were five of them. So maybe, you know, get a map out, plan a little road trip, and go visit these libraries. They're great resources, and we want to encourage as many people as we can to just go visit their local library. So take a trip. Also, Scotland voted, maybe you voted, on Scotland's favorite book. And we were pleased to announce the winner during Book Week Scotland. The winner is Irvin Welsh and Trainspotting. So congratulations to him. And, you know, we wonder how you feel about it. Do you agree? Do you disagree? Do you wish you voted? If you have a comment that you'd like to make, you can tweet us at ScottishBKTrust. Or if Twitter isn't giving you quite enough room, you can comment on Facebook. So like our Facebook page and join us there in conversation. As I said, today on the podcast, we're going to have a few examples of some of the events that were going on around Scotland. By no means is this an exhaustive list. In order to cover everything that was happening during Book Week Scotland, the podcast would run for about 18 hours, and we just don't have the time, and neither do you. You should probably be reading a book right now anyways. But we do have a few great authors on the podcast. We have Alistair Reynolds, sci-fi writer extraordinaire, so really fascinating to talk to him about what's coming up in his work. We also visited the Fruit Market Gallery in Edinburgh, where poets and musicians and artists were all hanging out with an event called In the Wee Small Hours. People were hanging out in the Fruit Market Gallery from about 10 o'clock at night till 6 in the morning. There were poetry readings at about 2:30 a.m., 6 a.m. It was a really fantastic event, so you'll be hearing a little bit about that. But first, Louise Welsh. She's a fantastic writer based in Glasgow. So we spoke to her about her new book, I Bet You're Intrigued.
My name is Louise Welsh, and my new book is called A Lovely Way to Burn. It's the first book in the Plague Times trilogy, which is the first trilogy I've written.
The prologue is harrowing, and the idea of the book, maybe you can just explain to people what's happening and what they can expect from the Plague trilogy.
Well, I think the ideas for this book probably started where a lot of ideas do, which is in childhood. I was brought up in the 70s and the 80s, and really at that point, we feared worldwide pandemic, we feared the nuclear bomb. I really am very surprised still to be alive and able to do this podcast. The Plague Times trilogy begins in London. It begins with a woman called Stevie Smith. It begins with an illness that seems to be taking hold of the city. Stevie finds her boyfriend, Dr. Simon Sharkey, dead in his bed. It looks at first like sudden adult death syndrome. It transpires that it isn't this, and that he doesn't have the virus. It was something else. And Stevie begins to try and find out what that was. And she gets kind of pulled into this quest, partly because it becomes dangerous for her. She needs to find out what's going on. But as she's pursuing the quest, the city is kind of dissolving around her. So it was great. It was very good fun to write. So it's kind of modern, dystopian, Ballardian, London-based book.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pandemic, right?
Yeah, so, oh gosh, listen, the sirens, they found you, Ryan. They're coming for us. Yes, it's a pandemic, a plague of sorts, if you like. I drew very much on researches that I'd done into the Black Death and how people behaved then. You know, how does one behave when actually everybody knows somebody who has died? everybody has the risk that they might be taken as well. So I read things like Daniel Defoe's History of the Plague Year, which he's writing a good while after the plague, and I read contemporary accounts from that period, and I read a lot of historical explorations of it. And it seems what happens really, of course, is many different things. Some people get extremely religious. They think, well, this event, this mass death is something that God has sent to punish us. Therefore, we must be very, very good and try and appease God. Other people think, well, of course, this proves there is no God. And you get these kind of Hitler's bunker behavior, you know, lots of excess and drinking and desperation. And I guess I partly wanted to explore that world. What happens when the agencies around you begin to break down, when the police force is broken down? And I guess partly this book is set in hospitals, you know, which is a very gothic place. So we have a fear of hospitals, we have a fear of ill health, we have a fear of death.
Did you start with the notion of the plague off the bat, or did you throw around ideas in your own head of like, okay, I want to have a feeling where people are, everything's collapsing, we're thinking terrorism, it could be. There's loads of different ways to capture that feeling of a city in terror and a city in kind of in trouble.
I've known, I would say, for about 5 or 6 years that I was going to write a book that was set during some kind of pandemic. So it's something that I've been thinking about for a long time, and I guess I wanted to transport that what if, what would happen if something akin to the Black Death hit us in the 21st century. There are many, many more people around now. We're very sophisticated in many ways, but I can actually do less in a practical sense than my grandmother could, you know. And I remember speaking to this guy in Canada, and his family were Inuit, and he was saying all the things that his grandfather and father could do. They said, you know what, I can't do those things. I don't know how to do those things. And I guess that idea stuck with me as well. How do we cope once our sophisticated devices are taken away from us?
I mean, it's really thin, isn't it? That veneer between everything working and nothing working. And like, I couldn't repair an engine or mend a fence. I could totally look it up on YouTube. But that doesn't help you if there's no internet, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe it's a love of the book as well. You know, all our Kindles will be down. You want to find out how to chop off somebody's leg? You're going to have to look it up in a book, you know, if you're going to operate on somebody. But basically, at the heart of the story, I guess it's an adventure story. It's a quest. It's a chase. It's a fast-paced book, starring a protagonist who's very capable and very able and very feisty, and that was fun to do as well. So it's a kind of 100 miles an hour chase, and I enjoyed working with that structure.
Because there's this big chaotic set piece of a plague, but then there's in the essence of it, there's this kind of human story about somebody trying to figure out what happened to the person she cares about.
Absolutely, yes. And the book is set, as I said, partly within hospitals. And I was thinking partly about the National Health Service, and I was thinking partly about private medicine as well, the potential for corruption within the private healthcare system. And I spent quite a wee while in America over the last couple of years talking to people. People, when we go to America, always say, gosh, how are you coping with the National Health Service? You say, well, very well, actually. We love it. We really love it. So I was thinking partly about that as well. So there's an idea of corruption, private healthcare, and how far do people go for money? What would you do for money? Well, quite a lot. But would you do this? So once you've taken one step, you can take another step and take another step. And I won't go too much into the plot, but there's Stevie's boyfriend is a surgeon. He works in private healthcare with a chemist and pediatrician, and they've found out a new way of helping children with cerebral palsy.
I'm wondering what made you decide to turn this particular story into a trilogy? Did it come to you as you were finishing the first book, or was it something that you were like, okay, no, I want to do something big, and this is a subject that's meaty enough and has enough scope to be able to tell the stories you want to tell in that format?
The idea of writing a trilogy, of writing three connected books, I think is a part of the size of the story. I guess part of my inspiration, I think, comes from series like Terry Nation's Survivors, which was a series set in the 1970s. There's a mass pandemic. People have to try and rebuild society. And it was one of those programs that I was allowed to stay up late to watch. So it was a very exciting program for me. And I wanted, I suppose, to explore Stevie's story and then to look at some other people's stories as well and then bring them back together again in the final book. It's also, I guess, as a writer, this is my sixth book now, and I suppose you're always looking for some kind of different challenge, you know. And I've written two quite short books. Tamburlaine Must Die was only 40,000 words. The Girl on the Stairs is 60,000 words. The other books that I've written have been between 80 and 90. And the idea of writing three books that you could read separately, hopefully read in any order, but actually if you read them, 1, 2, 3 would give you another story as well, is quite an appealing one. You know, that you can have this jigsaw, if you like. And I guess as a writer, I am rubbish at maths, I'm rubbish at finances, but I think there's a mathematical aspect to writing which can be quite pleasing, that kind of problem of making things work in that way. So yes, so it's partly a challenge for me, you know, to keep me sharp and interested.
You said once that you found it challenging to write stories south of the border, down in England, and I'm wondering how you got over that for this particular novel, and was there something about like the epicness of plague in London that begged to be told from that city, that metropolis, as opposed to, you know, Stirling?
There were essential reasons why this book had to be set in London or a city of that size. So somewhere like New York, I guess, or Beijing would also have fitted in terms of size. And I guess that idea of a major city that is very, very multicultural, very busy, all sorts of people find themselves there just for a few days. You know, it's a moving, transient place, a real hub of transport and infrastructure. There was something essential in this story that it needed the busyness. It's also to do with the arc of the book, because the book begins in London, or the trilogy begins in London. The second book also begins in London. It begins with somebody who's been put into prison. And, of course, what happens if you're in prison when something like this happens? You're not actually much of a priority, especially if you're in the vulnerable prisoners' wing. Nobody's really that bothered about letting you out. And I want the book to begin in London, but then to begin to move north, because the impulse that I think most of us would have in a city like London would be to get out of it. So the books start there, but the final book will be located in Orkney. So there's a sort of coming, you know, a going north, and a going of trying to rebuild society. This book, as I say, is based thinking about health, you know, in the world of hospital. The next book begins in the world of prisons. The final book will have a religious aspect to it. What are the things that people start to rebuild? Well, probably religion's pretty high on the list. And is that a good thing, or is it a bad thing when we're looking for leaders? How much charisma do we want our leaders to have?
Was it difficult to write that beginning scene?
The book opens with a series of murders by people who are pillars of the establishment. And I guess, you know, there's an element of fun there as well. I wrote it at Cove Park. Strangely, you know, sometimes you carry things around with you for a long time. You write them quite quickly, actually, because you've been thinking about it for so long. So that wasn't particularly difficult to write, but a funny thing did happen with it. my agent, who is based in London, had the manuscript, and he had phoned the office and said that there had been a suicide on the line, one of the lines in London on the underground. And he'd phoned the office and to say to one of the girls that worked there, oh, you know, your line is closed home, you're going to have to get the bus. And then he pinged her this opening bit of the new book, A Lovely Way to Burn, and he just entitled it, What Happens in London When It's Hot. Then he made his way back to the office, and he got there, and there was an ambulance outside, and this poor girl had taken it off the photocopier, read it, not realised that it was a novel, had a panic attack, and had to be taken to the hospital. Because he emailed me and told me, and I was thinking, that is awful, but somehow it made me really smile.
Congratulations. I don't know many writers who can do that.
I hospitalized someone without touching them.
Thanks, Louise. A Lovely Way to Burn, the first of her plague trilogy, will be out very soon, so keep your eyes out for it. Up next, we visited the Fruit Market Gallery in Edinburgh to take part and get a little sense of their event in the wee small hours. It was a night when everybody was staying awake, drawing, writing, reading, playing music. It was really beautiful and a great excuse to hang out in the Fruit Market Gallery when it was closed. It felt quite secret and special. It was just a really fantastic Book Week Scotland event. So in this segment, we're going to introduce you to some of the readers who read their poems, and you're going to hear some poems, and you're going to also hear from just people who were hanging out and enjoying the scene at the Fruit Market Gallery. And we're going to start this bit with Ian Morrison, who helped curate and organize the entire night there at the Fruit Market Gallery.
Ian Morrison, and we're at the wee small hours at the Fruit Market Gallery as part of Book Week Scotland.
There's a huge crowd. It's already 11 o'clock. There's, what, how many more hours? What time are you guys going till?
I think we're until 7, so I'm going to be here till 8 by the time I've seen the last of the people out the door and got the things back to where they're meant to be at the end of it all. Currently a drawing workshop happening with Kate Davis, a brilliant Glasgow-based artist who's responding to the Louise Bourgeois drawings that are up in the exhibition. We're moving shortly into some readings. We've got a couple of excellent poets. There's David Hopkins, Vani Capaldeo. A bit later on, Samantha Walton is going to be reading as well. And we're also excited to have Jennifer Williams writing all night and reading whatever she's come up with, which I think is pretty brave for any poet to do that at 6 in the morning.
Nobody will be awake.
I will be awake. I'll be the best audience. I will be Mr. Attention. We're really excited to have music within the programme. It's kind of a first time for ages that we've done music in the gallery, but given that we had a whole smorgasbord of different things happening, it seemed that music was a lovely part of it, especially with the idea of lullabies leading you into the long watch of the night.
Where did the idea of this come from? Because like, that's a pretty ambitious thing, staying up from 10 at night to 6 a.m. and why is part of Book Week Scotland?
It's kind of one of the things where probably some of my colleagues will disagree with me about where the idea came from, but it seemed to happen quite organically from conversations that we had around what events we could do for the Louise Bourgeois exhibition, because she has this suite of drawings called the Insomnia Drawings in it, which she, as an insomniac, did over the course of 8 months during the night. And someone, I don't think it was me particularly who said it, and said, oh, why don't we stay up all night? But it was one of those things said slightly in the spirit of jest, whereas I think I was the one who was foolish enough to actually take the idea and run with it and pull all this together to make it happen. So yeah, that's the connection. It's because Louise Bourgeois, insomniac, we have the insomnia drawings.
She's got a quote on the cover of her book.
Has the day invaded the night, or the night invaded the day? And you can see the lithograph from which that comes over at the National Galleries at the moment. They have another exhibition of Louise Bourgeois. We're kind of in tandem with them. So yeah, that's where that comes from. Again, another perfect insomnia quote.
I really like it because the idea of staying up like and just doing something seems really great to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm well up for it. I you know, like staying up late at night anyway, so getting to be up late in a place that doesn't normally do it, it's that kind of fantasy of being locked in the supermarket all night and having to eat all the food, except instead of sausages and cucumbers, it's art.
And you can't eat it.
Don't eat the art. I'll get in trouble if anyone eats the art. But you can drink the whiskey cocktails, and you can eat the Tunnock's tea cakes that'll be coming out later.
Yeah, thank you so much, man. We're going to talk to some other people and just get a little portrait of this evening. Thanks for your work.
Thanks to Book the Book Trust for putting in some of the money for making the event happen. It's been a great pleasure to work with them, and we love doing something as part of Book Week Scotland. Hopefully we'll keep doing it as a partnership next year.
Sophie Cook,
what made you want to come to stay up all night here at the Fruit Market with us for Book Week Scotland?
I love Louise Bourgeois, who's the artist which has been showing the exhibition. So I heard it was her, and of course I wanted to come.
Have you been enjoying it so far?
Yeah, really enjoying it. Really enjoyed the drawing class at the start. And here I am, surrounded by Louise Bourgeois paintings with red wine in my hand and chocolate all over my fingers. It's a good night.
It's the middle of the night.
Hello, I'm Samantha Walton at the Fruit Market Gallery for Wee Small Hours.
You're going to be reading some poems tonight about 2:30 in the morning. We're sitting on these really cozy beanbag chairs. And can you tell us a little bit about what you decided to put together for this evening?
I've taken some of the text that Louise Bourgeois wrote in her insomnia drawings and some of the text that's in her notebooks and sort of scraps of paper, and I've spliced them with poetry of my own. And it's going to be a sort of multimedia sound extravaganza in the middle of the night.
And you're not going to read one of those poems because it's got the multimedia effect, so you're just going to read one of yours. But maybe what lines and things were you pulling out from Louise's work?
Just the ones that are really sort of quite emotional, quite sort of Freudian in tone, the ones that are sort of riven with sadness and sort of confusion and tiredness as well.
Like which ones? Do you remember any of them?
Yeah, there's one... where it's sort of, it's quite repetitive, goes something like, I am a bad mother, I'm a bad friend, I'm a bad daughter, I'm a bad sister, I'm a bad woman, I'm 47, I'm a bad artist, but I'm not a bad truth seeker.
It's really good. How did you feel when you were splicing them into your own work? Was that weird?
No, it was really easy, actually, because I'm kind of, I have that tendency myself, but you don't often get to indulge it because you feel your poetry has to be somewhat more organized. So it's quite nice to know that the people who listen to it as well are going to be quite fragile and like maybe less less exercising critical judgment maybe than somebody a bit earlier in the evening would be.
There's a real safety to operating at that time. Let's hear one of your own poems.
This is where we realize my poems are actually quite a bit like that. Okay, this one's called Circuitous. It's a base day today. In the doorways, people are waiting to grind themselves to noise. And women are reduced to proxies. Metonyms for disposable morality deferred for modernity's sake, open to heartache, flood, and to the West and its infections. We think we're immune in this anti-Nero, in this bad hospital for the stupid vintage rich. Sunlight is streaming through the antique glaze, and my love for you is galling you state over lemon polenta cake. I'm paraphrasing now, but it's something like I'm a borehole and must be plumbed for minerals and despised. Why not just say the water born from the rock is cool, but you have been raped by industry and in many ways naturally encased. But today I'm the one being reasonable. Vaguely glad it's ending. Even the solid ground pities you. You with your skull sunk low in wine and thick-haunched bee with the notes you collate which repay you with otherworldliness in moments. Hypertension throttled and heart stung as you pace the park. Shoe knot, a circle of promise which leaves you and the rest of galaxy pushing on a string. Old injuries beep down the blackened feeding tube. Clarty data, filings and distractions for service providers comatose on cash behind the blinds which have been pulled down all around. We pay up. And the souls I touch with my feet, which correspond to the street, really are responsible for the global tarnishing and the prophetic rumblings of the tectonic plates beneath.
And here's another guest wandering around. Who's this?
Hi, my name's Mary.
What made you decide to come to the fruit market to stay up all night with us?
Just the opportunity to partake in the drawing class, which was really enjoyable, and experience all the states of mind.
That's really good. That's really good. Have you done some writing as well?
Yeah, I've written a bit about water and how I feel about water.
You want to read a bit?
It says, heavy water from a comet came from space, exposing my skin to death.
What is it? Almost 1 a.m? You need to go to sleep already, it sounds like.
Well, yeah, no, that does seem quite dark. I don't actually feel like that about water. But obviously that's what's coming through from my unconscious mind.
Well, I'm really glad you're here. Really good to see you. Thanks so much for coming out.
Thanks very much.
Hi, I'm David Hopkins. And the piece that I'm just going to read one piece out from the set that I'm doing. Because this is an evening for insomniacs, I thought an appropriate piece would be this poem, which is called Sleep is Serious. Sleep is serious. Eyes shut up shop, mouth clamps down on small talk. Silence listens, frost watches, eyelash nestles on white field. An idiot lurches down the lane with a flashlight, drunk on daylight. Sleep is serious.
Yeah, sleep is serious, especially at 6 o'clock in the morning when you've been up all night hanging out and having a good time. I think everybody probably went straight home and got some good kip. So hats off to everybody who was involved in the Fruit Market Gallery. Thanks to David Hopkins, Samantha Walton, and of course Ian Morrison, who helped organize the whole thing. I hope you're all getting some well-deserved rest. It was really fun hanging out with you guys. And to close the podcast, we're going to feature Alistair Reynolds. Now, Alistair Reynolds has just completed and released the second part of his trilogy. It involves a massive journey through space, elephants, and really, really good characters.
I'm Alistair Reynolds. I'm the author of On the Steel Breeze, which is the second volume of the Poseidon's Children sequence.
Could you just tell us, for the listeners who don't know and haven't maybe started the trilogy, a little bit about the second installment?
Well, it takes quite a leap from the first book. The first book is about where we might go in terms of going back out into the solar system, colonizing Mars and the moon, and it's told through the focus of a powerful African family, the Akinya family. In the second book, we sort of skip a generation or two, and we pick up on some of the sort of the descendants of the protagonists of the first book. And we're also 200 years further on in terms of the story, and the scope of the narrative has expanded out beyond our solar system. We're dealing with the first interstellar expedition to another planet, so they're actually on their way to another solar system. And the sort of idea is that they've sent these robots ahead of them to prepare the sort of landing strips, if you like, and build the sort of colonies that'll be there when they arrive. But they're not very far into the voyage when they start having some doubts about, you know, have the robots actually done what they're supposed to do, and why aren't they telling us
it's all okay to land?
Yeah. So there are sort of some doubts that are sort of planted quite early in the book about the sort of exactly what's going on the colony. The first book, quite a sizable part of the narrative of the first book had taken place on Earth, in particular quite a few scenes set in and around Africa because of the origin of the family. And I didn't want the second book to be set entirely on spaceships in other solar systems, you know, in some sort of artificial environments. I wanted to try and keep some of the narrative taking place on Earth, and finding a way to do that was a bit of a technical challenge, but I think I sort of came up with a solution in the end. We get some scenes set in Lisbon, which is a place I'm very fond of. And so there's a lot of to and froing between action scenes set on Earth and stuff happening in deep space.
And in deep space, it's on the voyage, right? I mean, this is a novel about travel.
Yeah, I mean, they're on their way there. When we start the book, they're sort of 90 years into this 220-year interstellar crossing, because the big sort of deal with my books is that, generally speaking, you don't have faster-than-light technology. You don't have all the stuff that you get in Star Trek and Star Wars. So actually getting to another solar system takes lifetimes, as it probably would.
A heck of a lot of jet lag.
It's a colossal amount of jet lag. In fact, would you even live long enough to make that such a crossing? I mean, the characters in the book tend to be quite long-lived. They've had sort of medical life prolongation technology, but even then it's a huge chunk out of a life, you know, to commit to this. And I try and get into the psychology of why you would do that, and why what would make you choose not to do it. Why would some people choose to stay at home rather than commit to this kind of voyage? What kind of things would they start thinking about as they get near the planet? You know, would they think, actually, we quite like it on the spaceship, maybe we're not going to go down to the planet after all? And they've had time to sort of adjust to living on this huge spaceship, and in fact it has become their home rather than just the sort of the vehicle to get from A to B.
Tell me a bit about the idea of because in this future that you've created, Africa is an economic power and a technological power.
Well, there's an awful lot of science fiction takes a sort of Western perspective on the future. It sort of assumes that the future belongs to the West, and I think it's pretty clear that history doesn't seem to be trending in that direction anyway. You know, China is rising as a space power. India has just launched a vehicle on its way to Mars. So that, you know, there are exciting things happening from countries that are not the sort of traditional Western or Soviet Russian space powers. So I think it's kind of a natural thing to do, is to think about where the world might be heading in those terms. But for me, it was far more of a sort of emotional thing. Than that I was listening to a lot of world music a few years ago, and I was particularly interested in African world music. And a lot of the music I was listening to was from West Africa, actually, from Mali, because that's where, to be honest, a lot of the musicians that break out do tend to come from Mali, because they have such a vibrant sort of musical culture there. And I just started listening to a lot of this stuff, and I just had this sort of fleeting image of a sort of woman on a spaceship, and she was clearly of African sort of ancestry. And I sort of, what's she doing? Why does she look so concerned? What's her story? And that's the sort of seed of a novel, or even in this case, three novels, a trilogy. So it comes, the whole thing sort of came from just sort of like sort of emotional connection to a piece of music.
You're not making any predictions here.
No, I mean, science fiction is not about prediction, and you can pretty much guarantee that if you do nail your predictions to, you know, to a tree, you're going to be wrong.
Tell me about how the elephants work their way into this, because there is this, I guess, concern of yours between man, nature, technology, nature, artificial intelligence.
The whole thing about the elephants is I had a protagonist in the first book, Jeffrey, and I sort of knew he was some sort of research scientist with an interest in sort of some aspect of biology, but that wasn't really going to be the main part of his story. His story was about him being dragged away from that on a kind of treasure hunt. But then I thought, well, actually, I need to kind of work out what he actually does, what his day job is. I sort of gravitated to the idea that he was studying elephant populations. My wife had worked at an elephant conservation center in Thailand, I think. And so, she, you know, I've seen her slides of working with elephants. But it really wasn't something that I didn't have big plans for that to become a theme that would develop into the subsequent books. But once I got into it, I started thinking about, well, you know, actually the elephants are kind of interesting. And then in the first book, we find out that there have been some sort of attempts to sort of genetically engineer a subspecies of elephants for various reasons. And I pick up that on the second book, and we find out about sort of the ongoing story of these genetically engineered elephants. And then that becomes quite a significant plot strand in the second book, and I think an even stronger strand in the third book.
Can you tell us, since we're talking about the trilogy as a whole, can you tell us a little bit about the impetus for writing, just due to the immensity of the time and space of the story that you're trying to tell? And I'm wondering how you as an author deals with that, the immensity of both of like writing three large novels and also the kind of scope of the entire story that you're trying to tell. I mean, do you have wall charts in your house?
Actually, my house is basically one huge wall chart. I mean, there are a number of things came together that I'd written sequences of books that were sort of linked, and you could sort of say, well, that's a loose trilogy, but I'd never thought of them in, I certainly never conceived them as a trilogy when I was writing them, like the Revelation Space books. They're a linked sequence in my mind, not a trilogy. A few years ago, I was offered a 10-book deal, which was quite a significant, you know, sequence of books. Within the frame of that, I felt far more confident about sort of saying, "Well, I'll do three of them as a trilogy." That's interesting. Now I can actually do a trilogy. At the same time, I had visited Kennedy Space Center to see the launch of a space shuttle, and this was around about the time that the 40th anniversary of the moon landings was sort of kicking off as a big sort of cultural celebration, and there was a lot of renewed interest in space exploration. And why don't we do those things now? Why have we lost that impetus? Can we get it back again? And all that sort of started feeding into my thoughts for the next set of books. And I started thinking about, well, you know, let's think about a sequence of books which takes us from more or less where we are now back out into the solar system, but then projects that onto a much larger canvas where we actually get beyond the solar system and then out into the galaxy. And I started thinking, well, that's going to be like a multi-generational saga. And I quickly started telling people it was going to be a sort of 10,000-year thing. By the time I got into the second book, I downscaled it because I couldn't make it work with a huge generational gap. I didn't really want to sort of pick up on the eighth or ninth generation of this family. I wanted a stronger connection to the first book, and I actually wanted some of the characters to overlap a little bit, so I've de-scoped it in that sense. And the first book only takes us forward another few hundred years from the first book, and the third book will take us a few hundred years further than that. Emotionally, it sort of feels like the same arc. It's, you know, we are going from a small canvas to a big canvas, and then there's a sort of sense of closure at the end of the whole thing, I think. Every book I've written, I've always tried to take a slightly different tack at, you know, the mechanical process of writing it. Sometimes I just start writing with only the vaguest sense of where I'm going, which doesn't necessarily work that well. It's. I mean, I'm someone who feels fidgety if I haven't produced a certain body of work at the end of the day. So I don't like sitting around planning for weeks and weeks. I don't like drawing diagrams and thinking up character histories. I want to actually be producing text, but I can get myself into terrible trouble by writing too far into something without a clear plan.
What is it that attracts you to, I guess, space? Why don't you use something like speed of light travel, that kind of thing?
Well, I had a background as a space scientist. I was sort of involved in space science for nearly 20 years. The trick for me, or the challenge for me as a writer, is to find a way. It sounds terribly pretentious, but it's about relating the personal to the cosmological. You can deploy huge ideas in science fiction relatively easily. You can write about galaxies crashing into each other, or the Big Bang, or the end of the universe, or the ultimate fate of civilization in 10 billion years from now. But to find a way to relate that back to, say, the individual human experience is actually quite tricky. Because we don't have a strong emotional connection to the fact that, say, the Andromeda Galaxy is going to collide with the Milky Way in 3 billion years. I mean, if it happens, it happens, but it doesn't impact us on any sort of tangible way in our day-to-day lives. fiction hinges on human moments, human experience, good fiction. I think that the central challenge for me as a science fiction writer is to find ways to anchor those big ideas to some recognizable human moment. And I don't have a sort of magic formula for doing that. I just know occasionally it sort of happens, and I feel that suddenly feels like an effective point in a story. You can write science fiction and you can deploy these huge scientific and cosmological themes, but if you're not careful, it can be very bloodless and very of no great interest to anyone who's just, say, a casual reader of fiction. And I want to bring in more readers. I want more readers. I want people to read my books because of the characters and the interactions between the characters. And I want them to sort of recognize sort of human experience within the pages, as we do in all good fiction. But at the same time, I want them to get the trip of going out into the universe and coming back with your perspectives shifted slightly.
Thanks, Alistair. I hope you all enjoyed listening to that chat and that your perspective has shifted slightly. Thanks to everybody who came out to events, took part online with Book Week Scotland if you organized a big book bash. Hats off to you for doing that. Thanks to all the organizations and institutions that partnered up with us. It made a fantastic, fantastic week. And I think loads of people were just reminded of how valuable and important and enjoyable the book life is. So with that in mind, we're going to leave you now. You're going to shut off your podcast machine and you're going to get your nose stuck into something good. Maybe it'll be a copy of one of our free treasures books that are still circulating around Scotland, or perhaps you'll get yourself a copy of Irvin Welsh's Trainspotting. I hear it's Scotland's favorite book. That's all from us. And until next time, keep reading.